through the ancient olive trees, he saw the shuttered gray stone house. No one appeared to be near, so he cautiously moved into the garden. The heavy foliage was sweet-smelling, the air was fresh, and the sounds of the street seemed far away and unreal. He dipped his bare feet into the pool and found that the fish were friendly and began to nibble on his toes. For the first time in his life, he had a vision of beauty and peace. As this feeling settled down into the heart of a three-year-old boy, he lay down on the grass and fell asleep. At least for one soul in Israel there was peace in December 1949. Yuri awoke from what seemed like a long, long sleep. And he knew by his stomach clock, and by the shadows, that he had missed his noonday meal. He decided to take a trip round this vast scented forest before going home. As he reached the south side of the pool, with the sun at his back, he looked up at the clear sky over the pool. Slowly settling down from the sky was a huge, silent, bowl-shaped object. He stared in fascination. What kind of an airplane was this? All the planes his father had shown him were wonderfully noisy things with bird-like wings. This one was as quiet as his garden. It looked like the bottom of his mother's huge aluminum bowl, which she used to wash vegetables. It gave him a feeling of peace and beauty and of strength like when he was with his father. Suddenly between himself and the bowl in the sky there was the shadow of a huge figure like the shadow of a man with a long cape, because there were no arms or legs to be seen. As he stared at this figure, a blinding ray of light came from its head and struck Yuri so forcibly that he fell over backward and into a deep sleep. Again he slept for several hours to be awakened by the chilling shadows of the setting sun. He leapt up cold and hungry. He looked to the sky for the bowl, but it was gone. He remembered the blinding light of the shadow man, and somehow it made him feel good. He ran to the fence, found his loose board, scuttled through, and ran up the steps to the third floor apartment. His mother asked him where he had been for so long. He eagerly told the story of the garden, the fish that nibbled, and the bowl in the sky. His mother spanked him for being away and scaring everyone by his absence and then telling such a tall tale. So for many years he did not speak to anyone again about his secret garden or the bowl in the sky. For a while he would return to the garden and await the bowl. But when it did not reappear after a few months, he forgot all about it. The only recreation that Turi's mother, Marguerite, had was playing cards at the homes of her friends. When she returned, Yuri would awaken, tell her how much money she had won or lost, and go back to sleep. Marguerite was amazed because he was always accurate down to the last piastre. How did he know this? She didn't think about it too much, but made it into a guessing game that she and Yuri would play when she came home. Itzhak was scarcely aware of this aspect of his son's life, because he saw less and less of him and because it never occurred to Marguerite to tell him. Ever since the United Nations resolution of November 29, 1947, to set up the independent Arab and Jewish states in Palestine, he had spent more and more time soldiering. When on May 14, 1948, the leaders of Jewish Palestine declared their independence and proclaimed the State of Israel, he had given up trying to live as a civilian and had returned to being a professional soldier. When he did see his son Uri, he talked only about his life as a soldier, of raids, guns, and skirmishes. It made Uri proud of his father to know that he was guarding all the people from harm. Yuri decided that he wanted to be a soldier when he grew up and guard the people from the ever-lurking dangers. Itzhak had no idea that his son was developing a reputation as an extraordinary guesser. Yuri continued to play in the garden of his Arab host. In the years that he had this sanctuary he never met anyone else in this garden, and he wondered who his host really was. Although he never met his host or discovered anything about him, he instinctively liked him for letting him play in his garden. In June 1953 Yuri Geller was squirming in his seat in the torrid heat of a Tel Aviv summer day. The teacher droned on about the correct formation of Hebrew letters. He looked at his new wristwatch. It said 10:30 a.m. Would noon ever come so that he could get out of this classroom and dip his toes in the pool of his cool garden? He thought for a moment of the metal bowl in the sky. Why didn't it come back? He looked at his watch again. It now said 12 noon. He jumped up and started to leave the room. No one else moved. The teacher stared at him and then at the wall clock. The time on the wall clock was still 10:30. He backed into his seat. He furtively stole a look at his wristwatch. It said 12 noon. He stared at the watch. What could be wrong with it? When he saw his mother at dinner that evening after his visit to the Arab garden, he said, "Mommy, that watch you gave me for my birthday, something is wrong with it. The hands keep jumping around." Marguerite looked at the watch. It was an hour and a half fast, perhaps it needed to be adjusted. "I'll take it to the jeweler, he'll make it run nicely." A week later Uri had his watch back. It was another hot, steamy day. He wished school were over. He looked at the wall clock. It was only 10:30 a.m. He looked at his wristwatch. It said 12 noon. He was angry. He thought, "Stupid watch, work right." He looked at the watch again. It was 11:30 a.m. He looked around to see if any of his classmates were watching him. No one paid any attention. Then he closed his eyes, wished hard that it would be 12 noon and that class would be over. He peeked at his wristwatch and it said 12 noon. He felt his heart leap. But when he looked at the wall clock, it was 10:31 a.m., and his heart sank. He couldn't get out of this classroom. He looked back at his wristwatch, which now read the same as the wall clock, 10:31. Now he was getting angry. He whispered to his friend Mordechai, "Here, take my wristwatch, and tell me what time it is." Yuri concentrated again, hoping that the school day would end. Mordechai whispered excitedly, "It is 12 noon on your watch, but it was 10:31 minute ago." The two boys played this game until recess time at 12 noon. They went into the playground, and Mordechai excitedly asked Yuri, "What kind of a trick watch is that? How can I do the same trick?" "It's not a trick watch. I just wished it to move," Mordechai screamed with laughter until a crowd gathered around. Tears ran from Mordechai's eyes as he gasped to the crowding children, "Yuri's got a trick watch, and he can move the hands with the trick. But he is trying to fool me by saying that he can make the hands move by wishing. He can't fool me, it's a trick watch." The children wanted to see the trick. Yuri didn't know what to do with all this laughing and cheering. It wasn't a trick watch. "All right," he blurted out with unexpected authority. "I'll show you. Mordechai, show everyone the time, and then put the watch on the ground so that no one touches it." Mordechai did as he was told, and everyone saw that the time was 12:10 p.m. The watch was placed on the ground face down. Yuri suddenly liked being the center of attention. He dramatically placed his left hand across his forehead and tried to look like he was concentrating. He felt as though he was being watched by everyone. He said to himself, "Watch. Please move the way you did in class." The school bell suddenly began to ring. Mordechai picked up the watch. Everyone crowded around him. The clock hands were at 2 p.m. What a great trick. "Where did you get the watch?" "Let's do it to the school clock," exclaimed the children as they straggled into the classroom. Yuri was very, very quiet. The watch was not a trick watch. Why did it move? He tried once more. He set the watch hands at 12:15 p.m., the same as the wall clock. He closed his eyes and made a wish for the hands to move back to 12 noon. When he looked at the watch, it was 12 noon. It had worked. He was unsuccessful, however, in any attempts to affect other clocks than his own. Over the next few weeks, Uri's classmates never tired of wanting to see his trick watch. He tried to please them, but they only seemed to want to tease him into revealing the trick. When he insisted that it was not a trick watch, they began to jeer at him. Finally, he became so hurt that he refused to do it anymore. But secretly he continued to move the watch hands. He found that he could move the hands only when he was in school. He could never do it at home alone or in his garden. He wondered why it worked only in the midst of his crowded classroom. But because the watch trick did not make him popular with anyone, even Mordechai, he gradually stopped trying to move the hands by wishing. In Israel, shortly after Uri had passed his 9th birthday, Marguerite had met Ladislas Juro, a pianist who had taken a great interest in her. She wanted very much to be with Ladislaus but did not want to offend Uri by having him see her with a man. She solved the problem by arranging to have Uri live on a kibbutz not far from Tel Aviv. When his mother left him at kibbutz Hatzrashlid, Uri ran away and hid for several hours. Not only was he hurt by being parted from his mother, but he feared having to deal with a lot of new people. He came out of hiding as he got hungry and walked into the communal dining hall. A friendly girl escorted him to the cafeteria and then led him to their quarters. It contained sleeping arrangements for 8 children, 4 boys and 4 girls, and their teacher. This area also contained their classroom. Since Ashlid was subject to sudden raids from Arabs in the nearby Gaza Strip, the children were thoroughly drilled to be constantly alert to danger, and what to do about it. Although Uri was now a part of a real family for the first time in his life, and everyone was very good to him, he could not get used to this public life. He was always being kidded about being stuck up and a loner. And, in fact, try as he could to change his attitude, he really was most comfortable when alone. He tried to make friends on his own terms by showing his watch trick to his classmates, but somehow it did not work to make him popular. Nor did his unusual quickness in class endear him to them. So he spent much time out in the orange groves by himself. He was happy only when his mother came to see him on Sabbath. But he was not too happy when she brought Ladislaus. Oh, Ladislaus was all right, but his mother didn't pay enough attention to him when Ladislaus was around. One day Uri was called out of his class to see a visitor. As he came up out of the stairway into the bright sun, he could scarcely see the figure in front of him. It was his father in full battle dress. Uri jumped on him with joy. His father led him out to the road, where there was a company of 8 tanks, each looking like a powerful fortress. Itzhak said to Uri, "This is my group, and the front tank is the lead tank under Captain Avaram. I'm his sergeant major. We are going off on maneuvers to the border. Hop in and I'll give you a ride, and then you can hitch ride back here." The excited child climbed into the Sherman tank and found himself in a blazing hot hellhole where the noise was deafening. His father tried to point out where the gun controls were, but he couldn't hear a thing. Before he knew it, the tank lurched to a stop. He was handed up the hatch, and his father was standing in the dust with him. "Uri, don't say anything to anyone, but war may come any day. This time it looks bad because the Russians have armed the Egyptians to the teeth. Always remember that I love you, and I only go to battle to protect you. Shalom, shalom, son." And his father was gone down the road in a whirlwind of dust. Uri stood there for a long time, trying to remember something in a garden when he was 3 years old. But he could not recall what it was. He placed his hand on his head and prayed to God for his father. He didn't want to hitch back to the kibbutz, so he walked in the dust and heat. 2 weeks later, on October 29, 1956, Itzhak's tank unit got orders in the early dawn hours that war was on, and to get to the Suez Canal without fail. Itzhak's unit battened down the tank hatches and raced toward the Mittler Pass. As they entered the pass, they could clearly see the massive Russian tanks strategically placed on each curve and hillock. Itzhak thought, "God, how can we survive this gauntlet? Sooner or later they will get us." There was no further time to think. The first Egyptian tank was coming within gun range. Itzhak's commander, Captain Avaram, then shouted a radio order to all his tanks, "Don't fire, wait." Everyone thought, "He is mad. We'll be blasted to bits at this point blank range." But Captain Avaram showed even more madness. He lifted the turret lid and stuck his head out. "The fool," thought Itzhak. "He wants to be the first to go." Strangely enough, all of Captain Avram's men held their fire. An uneasy calm came over each of them as they came up to the first Egyptian tank and saw that the Egyptian soldiers were staring at them as though hypnotized. As the Israeli tankers passed one Egyptian tank after another, it was the same story. The Egyptians stood with hands frozen on the triggers of their guns. Captain Avram's men opened the hatches of their tanks to stare at the Egyptians as they raced on in the eerie silence of Mittler Pass. Unit after unit of the Israeli tank corps raced by the paralyzed Egyptian soldiers. Finally, When enough Israeli armor had pierced through the pass, the Egyptians began to surrender voluntarily. To this day, no one has ever explained what happened that day to give the Israeli army complete victory over superior forces. When the war started on October 29, 1956, Uri and his friends were kept in their bomb shelter for 4 days. They listened to the radio and prayed many times each day for their parents and that God would spare Israel as he had in the times of Moses. Uri kept wishing especially for the safety of his father. 2 weeks later he received a message that his father was alive and was going to visit Uri on the following day. Uri stood in the road all day where the bus stopped, waiting for his father. This was the longest day of his life. When he was about to give up, a bearded, dusty soldier leapt from the back of a truck with 2 rifles. It was his father. Uri rushed up and got scratched by his father's new beard. He was bear-hugged till it hurt, but he didn't mind. His father stayed at the kibbutz that night and told the marvelous tale of how God had led them through the Mittler Pass, going almost invisibly past the huge Russian-built tanks. Uri slept very soundly that night, knowing that God watched over Israel and that his father was safe. In the fall of 1957, Uri left the kibbutz and came to live with his mother again. His mother confided that Ladislas had asked her to marry him. What did Uri think? Bravely he replied, "Mother, you do need a friend. You are always alone. Does this mean that you would not have to go to work every day?" "Thank you, Uri. Yes, I would not go to work. You see, Ladislas owns a small hotel in Cyprus, and we would all work together there." "Where is Cyprus? Is it like the kibbutz?" "I didn't like it there at all." "No, Uri, it is not like the kibbutz at all. Cyprus is an island." "An island? That sounds great. What's on the island?" "It is a very civilized place with resorts, mountains and different people live there, Greeks and Turks." "Mother, what are Greeks and Turks?" "Well, you see, we are Jews." "But, Mother, what are Jews? I thought we were people like everyone else." "My father talks about Jews and the covenant with God and the promised land and how God helps the Jews when they are in bad trouble." "But why should God do this only for the Jews? How do you become a Jew?" "Stop, Uri, I can't answer all those questions at once. First, you are a Jew because your mother is a Jew. And I am a Jew because my mother was a Jew, and so on all the way back to the beginning of our history, which starts with a man called Abraham. He was not Jewish, but God came to him here in Israel and said, 'Walk in my ways and be blameless. I will establish my covenant between me and you, and I will make you exceedingly numerous.' And God and Abraham entered into an agreement. And all of Abraham's descendants became the Jewish people. But, Mother, I don't feel like a Jew. Why is that?" "Well, you see, your father and I agreed when you were a baby that it was enough for you to be brought up in freedom here in Israel. We didn't want you to have to go to shul and be told a lot of things about Judaism while you were too young to understand. Because you have not gone to shul and do not know the synagogue, no one has pounded it into your head that you are a Jew. You are a citizen of Israel, that is enough. When you grow up, you can decide for yourself if you want to be a Jew." "I understand, Mother," Uri said very gravely, and left the room. From now on he began to notice who was a Jew and who was not. He found that those who were religious Jews spent a lot of time praying and eating special foods and obeying many rules. Those who were not religious spent more time playing and at the beach and were not fussy about food and rules. Both Jewish groups got along well in Israel. As 1957 came to an end, and his 11th birthday approached, Uri got more and more unhappy about leaving his cozy apartment and the garden across the street and about the prospect of going to a place where no one spoke Hebrew. Somehow, he could not like Ladislas, although Ladislas was very nice to him. When they finally moved to Cyprus in early 1958, Ladislas bought a beautiful fox terrier for Uri, which the boy named Joker. The name of the small hotel on No. 5 Pantheon Street, in Nicosia, was the Ritz. It was a marvelous place. It had many rooms, and Uri would explore them after each guest left, hoping to find some treasure. He shared his own small attic room with Joker. Living in Cyprus made him aware for the first time that he was a Jew. He attended the Terra Santa College presided over by Father Massimino, the Catholic priest. Most of the boys in the school were American or English, whose parents were stationed on Cyprus with some military job or other. Yuri learned to speak fluent English in 2 months, much to everyone's surprise. Neither Marguerite nor Ladislas ever learned English. Since they spoke Hebrew very poorly, Yuri spoke to them in Hungarian, which he had spoken since childhood. In the streets of Nicosia, which were as noisy and dusty as the old quarter of Tel Aviv, his fine ear soon mastered the Greek language. As these four languages flowed easily through his mind, so did the customs and peculiarities of each of these peoples. In class, his teacher, Brother Bernard, told his young students of the life of a Jew who had lived in Nazareth in Israel. Yuri's father had once taken him to Nazareth while they were en route from Tel Aviv to Safat near the Sea of Galilee. This man from Nazareth was called Jesus, and considering what a tiny hillside town Nazareth was above the valley of Jezreel, it was hard for Yuri to understand why he should be so revered here in far-off Cyprus. Yuri's strongest memory of Nazareth was that as you entered the hot dusty town and went up and down the narrow stone streets, you were flooded with the smell of fish. It was puzzling why Jesus, a Jew, was popular only with these Catholic people, and not with Jews. When Jesus was born, there appeared a star in the sky that had never been seen before. Brother Bernard chuckled when he told the boys that the star then was a lot like the lit-up spacecraft that people were now seeing all over the world. And this star slowly moved in the heavens by day and by night, leading three wise men who were seeking the Messiah. Although Jesus was born in Bethlehem, he grew up in Nazareth. As he grew up, he began to show a wisdom and knowledge unlike that of anyone else around him. Yuri impulsively blurted out, "Brother Bernard, could Jesus move the hands of a watch without touching it?" Everyone burst out in laughter at this crazy question. Brother Bernard rapped for order and said to Yuri gently, "You see, they did not have watches in Jesus' time, so the answer to your question is no. But he could do other things like that. For example, changing water into wine or making many loaves of bread out of one." Yuri was embarrassed by the laughter and didn't really know why he had asked the question. Of course, no one on Cyprus knew that he had once been able to move the hands of a watch. But somehow he liked this man Jesus, especially the boy Jesus. It seemed that he could do things that nobody else could do, and people laughed at him. What's the use of telling people your secrets if they laugh? Besides, all these people in Cyprus who believed in Jesus, and went to church every day, were also out in the streets fighting every day. The great riots between the Greeks and the Turks were heavy in the air and ready to explode at any moment. Why did not the Greeks heed the peaceful words of Jesus and the Turks heed the tolerant wisdom of their prophet, Muhammad? In the intense emotional heat of Cyprus there was also cool sanctuary. Yuri and his dog Joker had found some deep, seemingly endless, cool caves in the hills above Nicosia. Here with his flashlight, the security of Joker, and his tingling sense of excitement, Yuri found peace and happiness. People were all right. But to be alone in these cool caves was joy. For Yuri, these caves were magical. Somehow, when he was in them, he felt complete security, as when his father's arm was around him. He felt a peace and serenity that he could not understand. It was like the garden of the Arab villa in Tel Aviv. As Yuri reached his 12th birthday, no one in his family told him that it was time for his bar mitzvah ceremony when a boy becomes a man and is formally accepted into the ancient religion of Judaism. But this did not interest him very much. Religion in Cyprus seemed to him very unattractive. The Orthodox Catholic Greeks were forever in riots with the Muslim Turks. On the street where he lived there was a charming old Muslim scholar, Mustafa Sayabud. He was called an ulema by his fellow Turks, which meant that he was learned in the Quran and taught the young people from it. He seemed to take an interest in Yuri for reasons unknown to Yuri. When ulema stopped Yuri with a nice Turkish sweet, the two would chat in Greek. The ulema once asked Yuri why he did not wear the Jewish skull cap, the yarmulke, like the other Jewish boys. Yuri replied, Wearing a cap will not make me a better Jew. Being a Jew is like being anyone else. All you have to do is believe in God.
I believe in God.
Aluma gently replied. You are wise. To be a Muslim means the same thing. Muslim means to submit to the will of Allah, and Allah is our word for God. This is the same as to believe in God. You know we Muslims and you Jews believe in the same God. Yuri hastily interrupted, then why are the Jews and the Arabs, who are Muslims, always fighting? My father has to fight with the Arabs all the time because they want to take our land and homes away from us. My son, said Aluma with a tear welling in his eye, your El and our Allah are one and the same. He always spoke to his people through his prophets. Our common ancestor and prophet is Abraham, and so is Moses. Jesus, whom the Greeks here in Cyprus worship, was a Jew who was rejected as a prophet by his own people. We Muslims accept Jesus, but not all the doctrine that Christians have added to his name. The next prophet that God spoke to was our Muhammad, who is not accepted by either the Christians or the Jews. You see, over the centuries these three faiths have at times fought each other, and at times have known peace. Did you know that the Jews, the Christians, and the Muslims all consider Jerusalem to be a holy place?
No, I didn't.
Tell me why this is so. Yuri replied with an intensity that surprised the old man. The Aluma slowly leaned back and lit his pipe as he got ready to tell a story. It all started with Abraham, whose name was Abram then, who was brought up in the very ancient city of Ur in what is now Iraq. Did you know that Ur is the most ancient word that we have for light and that your name, Yuri, also means light in Hebrew? Well, God came to Abraham and told him to leave his home in Haran, to carry out a job for God in the land that is now Palestine. What kind of a job could an ordinary man do for God? Interrupted Uri. After all, God can do everything. We don't know for sure what kind of a job, but our books, the Bible and the Quran, tell us that it was something very difficult and not easy to explain. God asked Abraham to enter into a covenant in which he would believe in him and worship him. If Abraham did all this and passed this covenant on to his descendants, there would eventually come the perfected man. Abraham entered into this covenant at Hebron, which is in Palestine between the Mediterranean Sea and the Dead Sea. My son, I believe that it is the will and the compassion of Allah that all men love him, and love one another. I believe that another prophet shall arise whose task will be to lead all men back to the true love, the only God, for there is but one God. It is man who has made so many gods. My son, I am a Muslim, and you were born a Jew. Let us agree that there is one God who made man and that it is wrong for us to hate or to fight. Yuri looked at him thoughtfully. Yes, I agree to try not to hate, or to fight, and I believe in God. Yuri turned away and walked up the cobbled street to get Joker and to go to the caves. One day about a year later Yuri was in his attic room doing his homework when he heard a noise in the attic part that no one used. He thought that maybe a bird had gotten trapped. He took a flashlight and gingerly stepped over the open rafters of the rooms below, seeking to find the bird. When he got to the far end, the sound had ceased, and he stood still for several minutes to listen for a bird. Suddenly, a door slammed in the room below. He heard voices. Light was coming up through the attic floor from the room below, right at his feet. Slowly he lay down on the rafters, put his eyes to the crack, and listened. The man doing most of the talking was a Jewish grain buyer, Joef Shachem, who stayed at the Ritz when he was in Cyprus. The other men were strangers to Uri. They were speaking in Hebrew. Joef was telling a man he called Amnon, you will leave for the Sudan in 2 days. All of your credentials are prepared as Klaus Sachs. You will set up your agricultural equipment business in Khartoum. Send all your orders to Joel in Essen, Germany. He will ship out whatever you request. Max here will listen for all of your radio messages in Ethiopia. Remember, you have about 6 months in which to infiltrate the Egyptian army through the Sudanese. At these last words, Yuri's heart began to pound. Were they talking about a spy operation, just like in the movies? The meeting lasted for another hour, and Uri heard more and more details of the spy's plans.
He figured out that these men were Israeli agents and they were using his stepfather's hotel as a base. He waited until the men had left Joff's room, and then he tiptoed back to his room. He told no one of his discovery.